You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Saturday, September 2nd, 2017, and we are recording our private show from DragonCon 2017. Yeah. Thank you. We have a very obedient audience here today. Cheering whenever I tell them to. Joining me on this show are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
So, are you guys enjoying DragonCon so far?
Oh, God, yes.
Every year, but this one's...
My feet hurt.
Yeah, that's true. A ton of walking.
They would make so much money if somebody in the expo hall just set up a foot massage booth.
Foot massage? Right, or if they rented Segways.
Yeah.
But I've seen some Segways.
Segways are the precursor to the movie WALL-E.
Yeah.
They put those everywhere. Ooh. We're all going to gain a lot of weight.
And experience bone loss.
Yeah.
Skeletons.
Good point.
So we're going to do a bit of an unusual format for this show. We're not going to cover any of the usual news items that we do. We're essentially going to interview each other. We each have come up with a question that's designed to be unusual, offbeat, but also provoke a lot of discussion and to be as intimate as possible. So we'll each get a chance to ask a question of one or two of the other rogues, but then we'll throw it open to whatever discussion we want to do. So does anybody want to go to first? Jay, do you want to go take your question first?
I have a couple of questions. One of them is, if you guys could do a career change, magically go back into your past and change the career that you picked, what would that career be and why?
And who do you want to answer first?
I want Evan and Bob to answer.
So it was around 7th or 8th grade, roughly for me, in which I was fanatical about astronomy. Couldn't get enough reading about it, learning about it through whatever the classes I was taking at the time would offer to me. And I even decided, in going to high school, you had to choose a language, and I decided to study German because there were a lot of German scientists, and I thought that would be a good fit for my future
astronomy
career.
How much German did you
career.
Take?
4 years.
You took 4 years of German?
Yeah, I did.
Whoa.
4 years of German.
I didn't know
in
that.
High school.
I didn't know that.
Do you remember any of it?
How well do you speak?
Yeah.
Of course. And I could probably get
very,
nowadays, I've lost a lot because I don't practice it, but I could get by in Germany, I think pretty decently.
Wow.
Verbs go at the end of the sentence in German. Just remember that.
And, that's bizarre.
And all nouns are capitalized, right?
Yes, all nouns are capitalized and there's no letter Y. It's a 25 letter alphabet.
Why?
Hey-o.
Nobody knows because there's no letter that provokes
extra
the question.
Hey-o.
It's verboten.
It is nicht so schlecht. At some point, I think in high school, I sort of veered off that course and went more into, although I was doing well in math, accounting sort of gripped me at a certain point. And I think for more economic reasons, financial reasons, I wanted to, you know, be a little more successful, productive money-wise. And when I did some research as far as how much money the two fields made, I made more of a decision to go accounting rather than the sciences because, you know, there aren't a lot of, you know, very wealthy scientists out there. And I think that was perhaps a mistake looking back on it in a certain thing. I feel a loss by having made that particular decision. And if I had to go back and maybe do it again, I think I would pick back up with an astronomy career.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Very cool. Yeah.
You see yourself like being an astronomer, like this is as a living?
Or? I see what Phil Plate has become, and I definitely could have seen myself going on the same course that someone like Phil Plate did.
Yeah.
Turning into, you know, an astronomer, but also science communicator with a specialization in astronomy.
Yeah. Do you know what type of astronomy you would have focused on?
No, not particular. Planetary, probably. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, Carl Sagan was so, you know, much a part of my life and still is. Certainly, I still love reading his stuff, watching old documentaries about him on YouTube. So he still plays a big role. That's what fascinated me the most about astronomy. So planetary astronomer, that's where I would have gone.
How about you, Bob?
A couple different answers to that. When I was in college, I had no idea what the hell I wanted to do. I picked marketing.
God knows why I picked marketing. It was the least offensive of the business specialties like economics or finance, which I loathed. So I took marketing. It was interesting, but I never did. I never had a marketing job in my life. Even
never
though I
had a passion for it.
No, never. No, I wasn't passionate about it, but it was interesting. If I could have do things differently, I would have gone into computer science back then. I mean, but I went to college in the 80s, so this is like a decade before even the web. So personal computers weren't, there wasn't much going on. So I didn't have the interest in computers then that I developed in the 90s and the 2000s. So I probably would have taken computer science earlier. In terms of a better career, if I happened to be better at math or if I was, I would have gone into astronomy or physics for sure. If I was a little more artistic, I think I could have gone into special effects, from sculpting and painting to now computer special effects. Those careers, I think, I would just find so fascinating. So that's kind of where I would have liked to have gone.
Yeah.
If I could have.
That's cool.
What about you, Steve?
I'm very happy that I went into medicine. I love it. You know, it's a fantastic career, and it's one of those things where you have to decide before you really know what it's going to be like. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. You decide to go into medical school, you have no idea what a medical career really is going to be like, unless, even if you have a family member who is a physician, you just don't, you really don't know what it's going to be.
And what about your specialty? Because don't you?
But yeah, those.
You take a little bit, but don't you really not even know once you decide to specialize?
Yeah, then you have to decide to specialize before you really know. And so you're really always deciding ahead of time and hoping you made the right choice. And people do switch channels, you know, switch careers. They bail on one residency and do another, which is great. I think if you feel like you realize this isn't for me, definitely cut your losses, you know. And it's never a bad thing. Like, you spent a year studying some other specialty in medicine. That will never hurt you.
Yeah, and it doesn't undo your medical degree. Yeah. You're still prepared to start in a new track.
It may not have been the shortest path to where you want to go, but it's not a bad thing. So, but anyway, I feel like I lucked out. I fell in love with medicine after I decided to go into it. I fell in love with neurology pretty much. I mean, I had to decide to go into neurology before I really knew what it was going to be like, and I definitely made the right decision. So I think I'm in the right specialty and the right profession. The only thing I could really say is that, and then I love being a science communicator, so I'm basically doing everything I want to do. But I could tell you what I would have done if I never got into medical
school. I know
what
it is.
What?
You would be a paleontologist.
Yeah, I'd be a paleontologist. That was my second career choice, was paleontology. That's right.
That's amazing.
And I think I would have loved it. You know, yeah. I think I would have been fine with that, but it just would have been a different, you know, specialty.
Totally different.
Yeah, very, very totally
different. More difficult in a lot of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. But I love paleontology, you know.
How about you, Kara?
Well, it's funny that you say that because I was going to say something different. I probably still will, but this triggered a memory. In my files, there's a book that I wrote when I was in second grade.
Cool.
We had an assignment. Our teacher gave us all these beautiful little white bound books that had blank pages in them, and we were to write our autobiography as if we were older. Mm-hmm. And when I was in second grade, also, I was quite young. Like, I was ahead in school. So I was 6 years old. So as a 6 year old, I wrote this autobiography, and I went to school to become a paleontologist in my autobiography.
Oh, that's awesome.
And then when I got kind of tired of the field work, I decided to retire that and take up acting. And then later in life,
You mean when you were like 9?
Yeah. And then I really, really retired into just, you know, being a New York Times bestselling author. Like, that was my career trajectory.
Wow, that's
as a sixth grader. So it's actually pretty funny looking back because there are some sort of parallels in what I thought I was going to do. Obviously, I don't act. I don't enjoy acting, but I do a lot of on-camera work.
Yeah.
I didn't go into paleo, even though I do still love it, but I did go into neuroscience. And it's interesting to see that even though this all felt very new and unplanned, in a way, I guess I always was sort of dialed into it, even as a six-year-old. But to answer the original question, if you were to choose a different path, I mean, I'm doing that kind of right now. You know, I'm 33. I'm a little younger than the other ones in the show. Not much, though. And I've been working my whole life in, I don't even know how to say that. It's not even my whole life. I did an undergrad in psychology, a master's in biology, started a PhD in clinical neuropsych, and dropped out to become a full-time science communicator. So for the past 10 years, that's what I've been doing. I've been working in television and the web and podcasting, communicating science and making a good living. And, you know, I've been a freelancer, so it's a hustle. It's very, very feast and famine. And like just now, literally next week, I'm launching into going back for my PhD in clinical psychology. Yeah. So I don't know if it's a full career shift. Mm-hmm. I love the freelance life, and that's why therapy really appeals to me, because I think I can continue my freelance approach and I can keep doing science communication as a clinical psychologist. But I also think that it's what I've always been working toward. It's what I have all of the academic background for. And as a person in Hollywood, a woman, especially in Hollywood, like, you don't know. You don't know what your length of time on the shelf is. It's a gross reality.
You're gonna get crusty really soon.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's like a really, it's a gross reality, but it's true. I might have a really long career in television. Luckily, I tend to do things that have a little more gravity. And sometimes that gives you a little bit more career security. But who knows? The American TV landscape is not very promising for science. So.
And how many women are out there doing exactly what you do right now?
There's a handful of us. I think that, you know, I do have peers that are really, really talented. You've probably heard of Emily Grassley, who does Brain Scoop, and Vanessa Hill, who is on PBS, and Jan 11 is about to do a new show on PBS. But I have one friend named Emily Calandrelli. She is a correspondent with me on Bill Nye Saves the World. And she, by my estimation, and I keep asking for people to correct me, but so far nobody has, by my estimation, as of today, she is the only female host of a science television show in America.
That's saying
like,
something.
Like, I've co-hosted plenty of shows. I've been a correspondent on plenty of shows, and I'm always working toward developing and selling and landing a show that's, like, solely hosted.
Yeah.
But it's very, very difficult to convince the television networks that, you know, people want to watch a woman on TV, sadly.
Reality TV is still...
It's crazy. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. It's like, you know, and it's been many, many times that I'm up for a job and I get the call back and the call back. And then, you know, I'm working really hard with the production company and the network executives. And then at the very last minute, it's like, and we're going to go with a dude that has a British accent.
Yeah.
He sounds more like a scientist than you. It's like, okay, whatever. But yeah, that's what, you know, that's how it is. So clinical psych, I think, will be fun. And to answer your question even deeper, right now the plan is to kind of specialize in death and dying psychology and hospice, end of life care, and also probably do some research in that area. If during my practica, my internships, it does not completely burn me out and I don't lose it, then I will continue down that path.
Cool.
If not, I'll respecialize in something else.
Evan, let me ask you, would you ever consider going for your PhD in astronomy now? I mean, it's never, you know, my wife is going for her PhD in her 50s. It's not impossible.
Yeah, not impossible.
It's tough.
I've not looked in to see exactly what that path entails at this point. And
be, you know, financially very hard.
Financially very, very hard.
It's a tough career.
Although luckily PhDs in I shouldn't even say non-applied, but non-professional programs are generally paid for. So, you know, if you get in with a laboratory where they have funding, generally physics, biology, chemistry, paleo, even those kinds of fields, you're fully funded. It's the applied fields like psychology are, you have to pay out of pocket, or like law, medicine, all of those fields you have to pay for your degree.
Yeah, there is that. I'm also, I admit, a little bit fearful of the physics component to all of this, because that's where I feel I'm terribly weak.
In physics?
In physics. Yeah.
I think, though, you'd be surprised by how different your brain is. Like, after you have a couple decades under your belt and you look back at the schoolwork, you're like, why? I mean, there's still things that are hard, that are even, you know, feel sometimes insurmountable, but everything's complicated when you're first in school.
And that's, you know, that's why I call it a fear, because I'm not sure it's really a rational sort of thing in my mind to understand that or think that way. So it could be just a hurdle that I sort of psychologically need to get over, but perhaps.
Yeah. And I've got to say, one of the perks about the program I'm entering into, a lot of the coursework is done online, which makes it flexible for my schedule. But also the average age of people who attend my program specifically is 36, because it's meant for people who have been working as social workers and as counselors who want to get the PhD and specialize and get their licensure. And there may be programs like that for a lot of other fields where it's kind of like career professionals who want to go back.
Mm-hmm.
And then your peer group, your cohort is a little bit more manageable. Like, I don't want to go to school with 22-year-olds.
Yeah.
Like, that does not sound like fun to me.
That's right.
Yeah. But, you know,
it's a different situation.
When people find a new career midlife, they're usually happier.
Yeah.
You know, it
Because I'm excited.
It's kind of like rebooting, you know, getting a second life. Yeah. You know, it's.
Well, I'll tell you what. If it ever does happen, I'll be able to point to this specific day and say that this was the acorn from which the mighty oak grew.
And you know what? My mom got her master's degree at 65 years old. Yeah, so that was pretty cool.
No, that's,
And it staves off Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Learning as an adult.
You better hurry up. So here, my quick answer to my own question. Mm. I've thought about this a lot. I would love to have been a filmmaker.
Mm-hmm. Oh, cool.
I am in love with the film.
Yeah.
Telling, you know, the story is told three times. Mm-hmm. There's the writing, there's the directing, and then there's the post-production. And all three of them, I'm in love with. I think the idea, like those, we did a panel today where we were talking about like the best moments in sci-fi film. And like, I literally get choked up when I watch Binary Sunset from Star Wars. It's so meaningful to me. And I want to deconstruct it. And I'm always trying to figure out, what did the writer mean? What was the director's interpretation? What did the guy or the person that did the post-production on that, you know, the editor, what were they thinking? And how did the three of them talk? Where they talk?
Is that the scene from your Skype?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the image.
That's like what we see when we're Skyping. Yeah, right. For Jay. Luke all the rest of us, it's our faces, right? But for Jay, it's that scene.
And to be, and you know, that scene is meaningful to me because it brings me back to a time in my life when I was a kid. And it was like me and my brothers and my dad was like always there. You know, it was like the best time in my, you know, my conscious life where everything was fun. I didn't have anything to worry about, right? So I admit it's a very interesting part to look back and go, man, that was like the carefree time of my life that I could be, you know, the kind of person that doesn't worry about the million things I worry about as part of it. But,
and again, I'm not saying that this is a practical thing, but you wonder, because it would be hard. You have kids, you know, you have a mortgage, you have a lot of responsibilities, but there isn't, you know, it's not impossible to consider the idea of going to film school at night or whatever.
Absolutely. And filmmaking is so democratized now. Like, you could make a film without going to film school.
Yeah, we did. It sucked.
Yeah. Oh, no, believe me, film school allows you to learn a lot in a brief amount of time, but like just doing the SGU videos that we've done, and we have an extra sitting in the audience with us here.
they were fun. But,
is that the extra? But
it's a steep learning curve.
But we, you know, every time
we're
do a project,
you get better.
No, absolutely not. Yeah. I was, you know, nowhere near what my dream level of storytelling would be. But that's what you have to do. You have to make a million films. Yeah, it's like being a poet. You have to write a lot of crap poetry before you might pick, you know, a good one out of the ether.
Well, and film school is one of those cool things where, like, you don't have to take the academic path. Like, you don't have to do USC's big film school. You know, you can take, like, American Film Institute courses or you can go to even community colleges and take, like, an editing class and learn how to use.
You know what, though? YouTube is amazing.
Or just watch YouTube videos.
It's just unbelievable, the brain trust that's in YouTube.
Yeah.
Jay, I've known the Novellas since 1992.
Yeah.
Is when I first met you. And Jay, one of my first recollections or deep conversation that we had early on, you were talking with me about a video project you wanted to do. It was going to be like a spoof on a kung fu movie or something like that.
Oh my
so
God,
ever
Jay.
Since I've known you.
Avita Zane Muchachos.
Is that what it was?
That's the name of the movie.
So I've always kind of known that about you. You've always expressed that interest, even, you know, going back 25 years.
That is so
that's
funny.
That's the first one. The second Kung Fu title I came up with was Kung Fu Manchu.
Kung Fu Manchu.
That's mine. I will use it one day. Yeah, I have scripts, literally, of like my funny Kung Fu movie. As a matter of fact, Perry was going to be, he was going to play both the big bad boss and the good, they were going to be brothers, right? He was going to be the bad guy and the good guy.
Man. Why didn't we make that?
I was so stupid back then, Evan. I was going to start building a set before I wrote a script. I was like, I'll build the set. I need his place.
I'll do
place.
The fun stuff.
Yeah.
I'll
do all
the crap. You know, did I talk on the show about the fact that Perry and I wrote several movie scripts?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you ever produce any of them?
So I wrote one for Perry's sister, Celeste, but I don't think she ever produced it. And then we wrote a couple other scripts that we never did anything with.
You didn't even LARP your scripts?
No.
You could have LARPed them.
No. So let me give you
that's not LARPing. Heard from the audience.
A really quick synopsis of the one that I thought was really good was it focused around a pedophile.
Of course it was.
So the opening scene is.
So this was like a life story type of thing.
Yeah, so there's like a 13-year-old girl in bed and there's like a 40-year-old guy and talking to her, and she's like, oh yeah, she's giving him instructions for going to the store and what to buy and everything like
okay.
that. And you don't see until he leaves that she's chained to the bed.
Oh,
he's actually her slave.
Is this like a horror movie?
No. And then
wait. He is
a comedy?
Slave?
What is that?
She is
his slave.
She's his slave. Okay.
So far, this is horrifying.
But she's getting a little old for him because he's already like 13 years old. So he's looking for the next one.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Uh-huh. Wait, I don't want to hear anymore. About
I know.
Wait, there's a good part.
Good part yet. No.
Turns out she's an alien.
No. he starts stalking this 11-year-old girl, like to replace her. But it turns out the 11-year-old girl is a brilliant psychopath.
Uh-huh.
And
cool.
she completely turns it on, owns him. Like she completely turns everything on him. And eventually, and the whole idea was that she forces him to face his internal demons and to overcome that in order to be able to escape from her clutches. Cause she's so brilliant. She manipulates him. She gets him to kill people for her. Like he
Whoa.
Like
completely
owns
so
this guy.
It's a psychological thriller.
It's a psychological thriller.
Wow,
sounds
okay.
really cool.
Yeah.
Actually,
and there's also at the same time there's a cop trying to hunt this guy down. At the end of the movie, spoiler alert, it's never going to be made. Is that he actually turns himself in because he realizes the only way to really get free of this girl. We were going to call it Megan's Law because that's the girl's name, and you guys know what Megan's Law is.
Yeah,
that's Nationwide, right? Yeah, we had this one scene where he first meets her. Where she has him meet her at a Chuck E. Cheese. You guys know what a Chuck E. Cheese is?
Oh, yeah.
And she's in that crawl thing, so he can't get access to her because she's inside that thing. It's too big, too small for him. So he could talk to her. She can talk to him in safety, right, in that location. That's when she starts the manipulation. Anyway.
Sorry, dude.
Wow.
Yeah.
Perry and I had so much fun writing that script.
That script makes me feel so uncomfortable, though.
It does.
Like, it's such a weird, uncomfortable script.
Even from the opening scene, like, the kid and the guy are like a married couple, and you're like, what the hell's going on here?
Yeah.
And then you see that she's tied to the bed, but actually she's actually controlling him too.
So he's really not, weird. He's an idiot, this guy.
He's got baggage.
There you go. You know, charitable description.
Which is actually not uncommon for dom-sub relationships, for the sub to really be in control.
Yeah, so but in this case, I don't think I would quite call this a dom-sub.
No, but that's the same kind of idea, that the people that he is controlling are really controlling him. Anyway. we had a lot of fun writing that.
Do you want to ask a question? You want me to ask my second question? I'm going to move on to something.
Yeah, go ahead. Ask your second question.
So my second question is, at what point in your life did you make a mistake that you regret and you would like to just magically go back and relive and redo that mistake you made or that, you know, that decision that you made that you'd like to undo?
I see an immediate look of clarity in Evan's face.
Easy for me. Well, I was married once before. My wife, Jennifer, now is my second wife. My first marriage lasted 4 months, basically, before we called it off and said, this is not working.
In retrospect, your first marriage was over before it started.
Yeah, it really was. I was just, you know, too infatuated with the situation to sort of realize it and put the brakes on before it actually became official.
Well, she had all of us fooled into thinking that she was not a psycho.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm grateful in that, you know, we don't have any kids together.
Yeah.
I have absolutely no contact communication and she's gone really from any thoughts I have. But that was the most upsetting time of my life.
Yep.
Was dealing with that and getting over that. And it took about a full year.
Mm-hmm.
And that was probably the saddest year of my life. And I don't wish that on anybody. And if I could do that over again, I'd do it. I wouldn't have gone there.
So what's the moment, though, when you meet her?
What do you mean the moment? When?
Well, he was saying if you could undo a moment. If you just walked right past her?
I would not have proposed to her. I would have instead used that moment to say, this isn't going to work and we should go our own ways.
Yeah.
I would have definitely turned that 180 degrees.
The one good thing that was happening then was I got to build you a house.
That's right. You were in the construction business with your
father. I built
your
one house and it was Evan's. We had a great time.
Damn fine. We did.
Yeah, it was
we were the co-general contractors on
my house. Is that the house you're still in now? Or is it
No.
Okay.
No, it's not. Yeah. It's not. But we built that thing from, you know.
Is it still standing?
Yeah.
Oh, it's there.
It's actually very close to where Courtney and I live right now. It's like like 1 mile from where
it hasn't
now.
Fallen in on its own. Not that I'm due to incompetence.
That's the owner's problem now, not mine. Caveat emptor. That's what I say.
All right, Steve, real quick, what do you got?
I mean, you know, one thing is that I think my wife and I waited longer to have kids than we should have. Because mm-hmm. We thought, oh, that's going to be so much work. It's going to change our lives. And we kind of, I think we put it off. And then, of course, it did change our lives, but in a great way. Yeah. We love being parents. We love our kids. Of course, I wouldn't go back and change anything because I have to have the two kids that I have now.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that aside, it probably wouldn't have been a bad thing to have them a little earlier. And then maybe I might have had three kids if we started earlier. I don't know. My wife might disagree with me on that. But
and I'm looking for her. Like, yeah, she looks horrified right now. Three
I'm
kids.
I'm the one who's got to squeeze it out.
That's funny you say that, Steve. Because Courtney and I, you know, we have a 4.5-year-old boy and a two-year-old little girl.
Yeah.
And I was like, me and Court always like, man, if we were five years younger, we'd have a third kid because of how much we love being parents.
All right, let's move on. Evan, why don't you go next? What's your question?
I have only one question.
Yes. 64
in
pops.
47. Yeah.
who gets that reference?
No.
No one.
One question.
Huh?
Nope.
No?
Good guess, though.
Yeah, it's generally Simpson.
Like, Rodney Dangerfield.
With 47 points.
Rodney Dangerfield.
Back to school, anyone? Back to school. 1984.
Oh, my God.
You can't hear me.
That's so
Evan.
Funny.
Oh, well. Evan, you want to hear something depressing? You said 1984?
Yes.
I was 1 year old.
And you didn't get that reference?
I didn't get the reference. I was literally born yesterday when that movie
Oh, gosh. Okay. So, thanks for making me
You're
feel
welcome.
Like a
yeah.
Very old. No, here's the question. And, you know, I know I'm supposed to kind of pose it to one person, but I'm going to ask everybody this. When did you lose your virginity? Oh, I mean, religion. Freudian slip. And we're going to go right down the line here. And I want to know if it was an event, if it was a series of events, long, short, whatever, however you want to talk about it. Bob, when and how did you lose your religion?
I had already been a skeptic for years, and we were never religious growing up, right? We weren't.
We had faith.
We had faith. We believed in God, but it's not like we went to church every Sunday. We weren't, you know, big believers, so it wasn't huge in our life. As I was learning skepticism and going through, we were skeptics for many years, at this point. And at some point, I just kind of like, I kind of thought about religion. I'm like, oh, of course that's bullshit. It's like, yeah, it's a no-brainer. And then that was it. So it was kind of a slow building process that I reached critical mass of skepticism and critical thinking. And then I kind of thought about religion and thought, oh, yeah, this is obviously nonsense.
How old were you?
I was in my 20s. I was
in
like
your 20s.
Late 20s.
Yeah.
But this is after we were skeptics for a bunch of years. These guys actually became atheists before me. And I was, which still surprises me to this day. Why did I wait to confront that? But I mean, it was a little hard, but not that hard.
You know what,
Bob?
It was in there. It was already cooked. You just didn't, front of brain, accept it. It was already, you know.
As soon as I took a serious look at it, I was like, well, duh, of course. It's nonsense. Cause skepticism and critical thinking explains so much about belief and why people believe in God and the evidence for God that it was a no-brainer. I didn't have to think anymore after that. So that's it.
Steve.
In college. Was when I went into college a believer, came out of college an atheist. But it was a process, and I think the process was a little bit more overt than Bob's. Bob sounds like it was more in the background and just realized one day you're an atheist, whereas with me, it was more, I went through very discrete stages of letting go of faith. So we were all raised Catholic with good Catholic guilt, you know, and while it wasn't a huge part of our day-to-day lives, we definitely were raised to think that faith was a virtue and you had to have faith to be a good person. And so if you didn't have faith, you weren't a good person. That was the hardest thing to let go of, that indoctrination into that particular piece. Yeah. And so.
Really? You felt that specifically?
Yeah, that specifically.
I didn't feel
like
that.
Faith was a virtue. Therefore, so I justified my faith. Probably for a while when I really, you know, didn't have to. But so it was like first, I mean, we were never literalists, obviously. We were always, you know, believed that, you know, in evolution. And we were, yeah, like raised Jesuit contextualists, you know, very scholarly version of Catholicism. But it was like, yeah, there's God exists and Jesus, you know.
Jesus was resurrected.
Heaven and hell.
The whole
heaven and hell, afterlife, all that stuff. And then, like, the magic sort of had to go away, obviously, with when we were becoming more skeptical, critical thinkers. It was like, okay, but they're still inspired by something spiritual, you know, by God or whatever. And then, all right, well, maybe, you know, even if there's not really a magical angle to this, Jesus' teachings are still good, you know. And then, you know, then I started to put everything just more progressively into context until I didn't really, I was probably then more of an agnostic. And then I can't, there was a moment when I realized I emotionally identified as an atheist, even though I was already an atheist. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Where it was like, wow, I'm like emotionally defensive and now tied to atheism as a worldview. Yep. And I've completely gotten rid of any notion that faith is a virtue. Right. And that was, I think that moment, for some reason I tied that to a conversation I was having with my father at the time, because he was, I don't know if you guys remember this, but when we were basically coming out as atheists to our family, which wasn't that big a deal, because, you know, our father thought that we were atheists because this is literally what he said, because we were just trying to get out of going to church on Sunday.
Yeah.
Right. I think that was him trying to rationalize.
Whatever, but that's what he said.
Yeah.
And I think most parents say that first. Yeah.
You know, yeah, that, I think that like in response to that, I was like, no, I'm really an atheist. Yeah. You know, and that's when I realized, this is.
Well, and by then you were an adult. You weren't like.
Yeah, in my 20s, but I was a young adult, but I was an adult.
Yeah, but you're old enough to decide whether or not you want to go to church on Sunday.
It was kind of still weird, you know, that, you know, like he feels responsible for making sure I go to church. Not like we ever went that much anyway, but it was just like, whatever.
There is still to this day something so familiar and comforting about going to a church for the few reasons that I still have to go, right? We just went to our dad's funeral 6 weeks ago, and I'm in this church, and I know everything. I know the rituals and all the songs and the smells and everything. And, you know, we grew up with it. It wasn't like, again, we didn't go every Sunday, but I mean, there is something about, it's cooked into my psyche, and I like it. I think I like the iconography. I love all the imagery. Everything about it to me is really cool. I'm a huge fan of mythology. So, you know, it is a mythos.
Yeah.
But it's my mythos because I grew up with it. But my answer, and to get more to the point, our sister became a born again Christian when I was 14. She went to college. Her first semester, she left my sister and came back a born again Christian, and she was not the same person anymore. I mean, personality change.
It infantilized her.
It did.
It absolutely.
So at 14, I had to face like religion in a very contextual kind of way. She came back and it wasn't the same person anymore. And I remember being angry at religion, like, it dirtied the whole thing to me. And then, as you know, then we're all the brothers are like, we started to sharpen our skeptical chops to one, kind of like help her. We were in the beginning, we thought we were going to help pull her out. And then it kind of turned more into a defensive thing where we were like, you know, I was almost feeling like we had to protect each other from this bad thing that was happening to the family because she came back brainwashed.
To get back to your question of when we lost our religion or virginity. I lost my religion before I lost my
They weren't at the same time.
They weren't at the same
time.
They
weren't exactly the same.
They weren't that far apart, but they were.
What would that be like? You're coming and you're like, oh my God, wait, God doesn't exist.
Okay, if you have any expectation that any woman on the planet came when she lost her virginity, you have no idea what is going on. Women's sexual society.
Good point.
No. That's very rare. I'm sure that is incredibly rare. But I've told this story like a million times, so I want to do a super fast forward version of it because you can like honestly find it on a lot of different, maybe even on our show, but definitely times I've been interviewed. But I was born and raised Mormon. My father and my mother both converted before I was born. They were both Italian. My mother's Puerto Rican, they were both Catholic. My mother's Puerto Rican, my father's Italian. So they found the LDS church together, which means that all of my extended family is Catholic. So either way, super religious. I was raised in the church, and at about 14, I told my dad that I did not believe, not just that I did not believe in the dogma, but that I did not believe in God. When people say, when did you first, this is when I realized it and worked up the courage to talk about it. I don't think I ever actually believed in God. I think I just was like really good at being obedient and going along with it. But there was never a moment where I was like, my questions are, I think I just never believed in it. But when I told my father when I was 14, so this was 8 years after my parents had gotten divorced, and he said, I quote verbatim, well, I have a moral obligation to God to force you to go to church until you're 18 years old. And I said, I am 14 and I am precocious and I have a lot of paper to prove that. And I bet you if we went to court and I talked to the judge, I could petition to stay with my mother full time. I mean, I'm at a good age of consent for that. And he said, that's on you.
Wow.
He didn't make me go to church, but he basically cut off my child support and cut off any communication with me when I went to live with my mom full time. My mom was always super supportive, but it was really tough between my father and myself for several years. Now we have a really good relationship. I mean, that's still there. It's not so much a sticking point as much as we both kind of feel sorry for each other.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, you're spending your whole life as a ruse. And he's like, you're going to go to hell.
Yeah.
So that's hard.
But you'll get the last laugh.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. Right? And actually, Mormons don't really believe in hell. They believe in something called outer darkness, where there is a gnashing of the teeth. I'll be gnashing my teeth for eternity.
That's so
sounds
weird.
Like a D&D realm.
Right? No, it's pretty cool, actually. For them, it's more like God is glory, and you bask in the warmth of God. If you're in the celestial kingdom, there's different kingdoms. And outer darkness is basically that God's warmth doesn't reach there.
So basically,
it's eternally cold.
You're just cold, yeah.
Yeah, it's like the opposite of hell in a way. Right. It's just this like kind of really cold, horrible place. But anyway, that was when I first, you know, I think about it now though, when I was about 17, I had a best friend, maybe 16, 17, I had a best friend who was super hyper religious and I tried my hand at it one more time, but she was more like, you know, Southern, I don't even know, maybe she was Southern Baptist, you know, one of those like, praise Jesus, and like go into church and didn't raise their hands and they sing all the devotional songs, very different than the church I grew up in. And I tried it for a while with her, maybe like a month or two, and I was like, oh, I love Jesus. And then I was like, what am I doing? And we didn't really stay friends after that. So I don't know. I always wanted to make sure that the people around me were comfortable. And when you grow up in the Bible Belt, like I grew up in Texas, I didn't know any other atheists. I didn't really have allies until college. That's where I started to meet other freethinkers. So it took a while. But I came out to my father at 14.
That's really awesome.
Kind of
that's pretty cool. You had it in you from a much earlier age.
I think I had a similar experience. We often, you know, there's a reason we call it coming out, because I think that like many of my, my LGBTQ friends, like there's a moment where you're like, I can't do this anymore because I'm lying to myself and to everybody else. And the guilt is eating me up.
Yeah.
That wonderful guilt that you so vigilantly taught me, religion, is turning on me. And so, for me, that was what it really was. It was hurting inside to lie to my family.
So it was a relief to do it when you spilled it.
It was a huge relief, but it was also devastating, you know? I had to weigh, it was like a massive economic risk benefit analysis. Like, is it worth it?
Came with the cost, yeah.
But
what
at least
a terrible
I have a
thing as a 14-year-old. What
well,
a
that's
terrible
like
thing to
what
have to
a lot of
with.
My therapy now is about, right? Like, because I was a kid.
Yeah.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about our sponsor this week, Lisa Mattresses.
Now, Lisa, this company named Lisa, they're an innovative direct-to-consumer online mattress company, and they're also socially conscious. So this is cool. What they do, they said that for every 10 mattresses that they sell, they're going to donate one to a shelter. This is what they call their 110 program. So the idea here is that they're trying to give back, and they're using sales to do this. And they also will plant a tree for every mattress sold and donate 1% of each employee's time to volunteer for local causes.
Yeah, that's pretty nice. So what we're talking about, though, is a mattress technology that uses what they call their patented universal adaptive feel. And that basically has three premium foam layers, including a 2-inch Avena foam top layer. That's, I guess, for cooling and breathability. Then there's a 2-inch foam memory middle layer to handle the contours and pressures of the body. And then finally, a 6-inch dense core support foam for durability and structure.
Yeah, these mattresses are available online in the US, UK, Canada, and Germany, or at the Lisa Dream Gallery in New York City. So try a Lisa mattress in your own home for 100 nights risk-free with free shipping, and get $100 off when you go to leesa.com/skeptics. That's leesa.com/skeptics. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. Kara, do you want to ask your questions?
Yeah. Oh, okay. My question's a fun one, just like my word of the week every week. It's a fun one.
They are fun words.
Limited vocabulary late at night. I want to know, and I want to start with Steve. I want to know, what is the thing, you know, we're all skeptics, right? And we work really hard to be as skeptical as possible and improve those skills. But there's got to be something in your life that you know you do that's kind of the least skeptical thing. that you're sort of ashamed of or that you're actively trying to work on?
So I'm not ashamed of this. This is something I'm simultaneously proud of, but also worried about.
Okay.
It's your movie scripts, right?
My movie scripts.
Yeah, there's something going on there. And once I get that degree, you guys, we're going to have a talk, okay?
This is going to sound bad. This is when I say it.
Oh boy.
The thing that is most skeptical, I think, about my worldview is my faith in humanity.
Wait, the least skeptical about your worldview?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I have more faith in humanity than I really should.
Yeah. Like based on the evidence.
Based on the evidence. The evidence is not with me on this one. I want to have faith in my fellow man, right? I think I try to focus on the better parts of human nature, the better angels of our nature, as it were. And I do think that people are capable of such goodness. But for me, emotionally, when, like, just the idea of somebody, like, being a good person to somebody else really gets to me emotionally. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm really sentimental about that. Like, in a movie, for example, the thing that will always get me is, like, is redemption. Like, you have a character who, like, turns from the dark side to the light side in any fashion. Mm-hmm. That totally gets to me. And so I always want to think the best of people. And I think, like, I want to think that our institutions can work. You know, mm-hmm. like, my fellow physicians are going to do the right thing. And, you know, Big Pharma isn't that bad. And there's got to be good people working at those companies that are not going to do these horrible things.
Yeah.
And I do think that people generally want to be good people. I think we all see ourselves as the good guys, pretty much. You know, there are some real bad guys out there, but I do think that the evidence is constantly working against that worldview. But I'm really reluctant to sort of surrender my desire to think that people are basically good.
Well, and also as a neurologist who has studied quite a bit of psychology, right?
Yeah.
And philosophy as well. And this is something that always fascinates me when you really start to dig into human nature and some of the things that sort of science hasn't been amazing at touching over the years that really are kind of in the philosophical realm. I mean, my personal view is that A, there's no such thing as evil, like that's not a force, and B, that when we talk about the fundamental nature of people being good or evil or good or bad, it really comes down to risk. It comes down to, you know, I think people often do bad things because they find themselves in impossible situations. Yeah. You know, they're having to make decisions for themselves. And so that super rarity of like somebody who is simultaneously got psychopathy and also is desperate and is making it is not really true to, you know, that's so rare.
It's rare. It's almost like 1% or whatever.
Yeah, it's like most people, but even most psychopaths don't actually commit crimes. You know what I mean? So it's like most people, maybe they're more neutral than good, but most people aren't like just fundamentally bad.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
So that's not really what I'm saying. So I kind of go back and forth. Like, and if I'm in a good mood, I'm like, yeah, people are great. If I'm in a bad mood, I'm like, people are fucking children. You know? Because people are both. I do think we have this duality. I do think, you know, that it's a pretty accurate description to say that people basically are chimpanzees and children. You know what I mean? We are operating at this really emotionally immature level all the time. And that we have this thin layer of socialization on top of that. The neurologist in me kind of knows that we're all greedy, selfish, you know, beings ultimately, that, and we do the right thing because we need to in order to live in society, to socialize.
I mean,
but that's the cynical view. And I don't really believe that,
it's somewhere in the middle.
It seems that way.
Right. It's gotta be somewhere in the middle.
But I think at the same time, people have a fundamental desire to be good, to see themselves as good, although that's ultimately selfish too. It's kind of a selfish, we want to view ourselves
good, right?
as
the
But there's hero a redemption, the there's a reason that redemption scene speaks to you emotionally and does to everybody else, which is why we keep putting it in movies.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that we see that in others and it makes us cry and feel good means that there is some sort
I agree.
Of
yeah.
thing
no,
in there.
No, and I do. I think that we just have to continually focus on that the better part of being human beings. I think we can transcend. We can be rational. We can be, you know, ultimately good. But it's so frustrating when we're not. And like you look at society today, and we're awash in irrationality. And it's so frustrating. Even so many simple things. We can't do anything right. And it's so frustrating. It's like, can't we just make a rational decision and do the right thing and move on to the next thing? We're still stuck. Why can't we get rid of daylight savings time?
Where did that come from?
Should be
why aren't we using the metric system? There's a thousands of those things. Like why aren't we just doing all these things? You know, why is there alternative medicine? Really, people? There's no magic. Stop.
Yeah.
And it gets so but it's all a matter of what you focus on. If you focus on the negative, frustrating things, you could really go into a deep pit of humanity.
Sure.
Sucks.
Yeah.
But you see if you focus on the good things, the science, the things that we can do, the rational, how amazing we can be at our best, then you're like, God, we can be so good.
We could be amazing.
And we could be so pathetic. Can we just move the needle a little bit to the good side? But that's kind of, I'm always waffling back.
That's a really interesting.
That's a good answer. I'm hoping that some people have like more juicy answers for me though. Bob, you are somebody who's really into like health and nutrition and fitness and stuff. I mean, we talk about this sometimes. Is there any sort of like borderline wooey thing that you do when it comes to
cryonics
the way you work out? I don't know. I have no previous knowledge of this. I was just wondering because
don't freeze
we're
up
both
on us
kind
now,
of
Bob.
Into that. And I think I see how much woo exists in that world with my trainer and stuff. And even though he tries to be good about it, I'm constantly like, no, dude, that's not a thing. Do you partake in anything like that?
One thing that I think about most often and what I try to tamp down on in me is my unbridled enthusiasm for future technology, which is related
to
my
enthusiasm.
I'm very, very optimistic about what technology can achieve. A lot of times I'll just say, you know, once we get mature nanotechnology, all of this shit, these problems are going to go away, including like, you know, climate change. I mean, so I've got to work at realizing that I shouldn't be quite that optimistic.
Gotcha.
I think I've reined that in a bit. I've reined that in the past few years. I'm a little bit more realistic about it. Still very optimistic. And I know there are technologies that if they were just here, they would be able to achieve, and they will achieve at some point in the future, amazing things. I mean, look what we've already seen, you know, look at this. This thing is amazing.
He's holding a cell phone.
It has taken over our lives. I mean, 10 years ago, I don't know what the hell we were doing without these.
We used to talk
these.
To each other. We used to look at each other during meals.
We still do that. It's a double-edged sword.
When we were going somewhere, we had to, okay, if we get lost, then we need to meet you at this location.
Yeah.
Right? We had to have all these contingency plans. If we got separated, because we couldn't just call each other.
And you know how there's like a pocket in the back of the passenger seat in a car? That's the map pocket. And there used to be like a massive atlas in there.
Map? Yeah.
What is this word?
Map.
Right?
So wait, none of you take a freaking multivitamin? Come on, Evan, what do you have? What do you do? There's got to be something.
Oh, gosh.
That's like borderline.
The last multivitamin I took was a Flintstone chewable when I was like 9. It was Dino, I think, purple, you know, grape flavor. Okay, so here's mine. At least what I think mine is. I've got a libertarian streak in me that kind of helps define a lot of my political views. Not all, quite a bit. And it took me a long time, and I'm still grasping with the concept of free will. And that, I mean, for really most of my life, I absolutely was convinced I do have free will, and nobody can correct me on that. It is, you know, regardless, doesn't matter really what you said to me. I am my own agent. Nobody else has influence over me, what I do. And I tied it into that philosophy, into that those political leanings that I have in my life. Now, I've kind of softened my stance on that a little bit from what I've learned. I still have more learning to do, I think, in this area. And I get now what the arguments are against free will. Yeah. And they're pretty sound arguments. They're pretty good. Yet there's still something inside of me in which I don't want to release that sense of control that I think I have over myself.
Yeah.
And because it ties into so many things in my life and my attitude towards many things, certainly political, philosophical, and otherwise. And I still clutch on to pieces of that.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I will ever really let go of that.
I don't know. I haven't fully let go of it yet, and I don't know if I will.
Well, it's really empowering, and I think in a lot of ways, studies do show that it's tied to a lot of like more positive psychological outcomes if you do have a strong internal locus of control. You know, if you feel like you are the captain of your own ship, that you're not constantly being victimized, and that, you know, the more that you feel like the decisions that you make affect outcomes in your life, that can actually be very empowering. But obviously it can be used to your disadvantage.
That's right. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to see the world with blinders on either, or, you know, or delude myself from what is actually reality. I really want to be as reality based as I possibly can. And I have abandoned many, many things in my life in order to achieve that. But that's probably the one thing that I'm having the hardest time reconciling.
Yeah. So long as you don't believe in the secret.
No, you can't just manifest things based on internal will.
It's all good.
Like that.
What about you, Jay?
Yeah, I mean, everybody's answer kind of inspired me a little bit. I mean, Evan, I think I relate to you the most, though. It's very difficult for me to be a skeptic because there is no buffer between me and a lot of very harsh realities. Mm. So I realized probably about 5 years ago or so, but you know, halfway through the experience doing the podcast, I mean, we hold each other up to a very high bar, right? You know that. Like, you know, we don't let any of us get away with any bullshit. You know, Steve really does ride Bob for being too, hey Bob, you know, for future stuff, you gotta chill out, dude, because it's not this. And everybody does that. We all give a lot of feedback and it's helped. But I've decided that I'm going to allow myself an out emotionally a little bit. And that is, I will always hope that there is some chance that I'm not going to die.
Yeah.
I just don't want to, 100% accept my mortality.
And I are such opposites in this, and it's fascinating to me, like, how much the whole thing, like, the whole death thing freaks you out.
I just don't want to, but I don't want to have to fully deal with it because I've already dealt with it so freaking much. Yeah. It's already had such a massive influence on decisions in my life that I'm like, all right, I'm going to give myself, like, this 5% buffer. That'll be my hope. I can have some hope, and it's kind of like my religion.
Are you going to cryopreserve yourself?
I'm not going to cry.
No, cry.
No, actually, my wife and I were fully into it, and we're like, you know, it's financially, we have kids now.
Yeah, it's expensive.
You know, that's basically like, I'm not the most important thing in the world anymore. But I just want to give myself that 5%, like, okay, I'm a science communicator. I completely buy into science. I know where I'm, you know, psychologically, you know, we're limited. We're limited beings. I'm as humble as I can possibly be about, you know, how intelligent I am and how often am I right. And, you know, I try to respect people, religious people, everything. I'm trying so much, but it's hard.
Yeah.
For me, I'm a hyper emotional person. I feel every single bump in the road, good and bad. And it's like, I think I'm a little bipolar that way. I feel everything. You know, I mean, this losing my dad 6 weeks ago, I mean, this has been like, I'm not even an inch out of it. It's still amazingly blowing my mind away, just trying to wrap my head around it. But I have to have hope. I have to. I have to always, like, I have my dreams. I want to build a house for myself one day. You know, I'm just going to allow myself to tuck it away.
Yeah.
I don't want to give it up.
I'm personally a really firm believer, and maybe it's the poeticism, but I'm a really firm believer that these types of darknesses exist. I mean, they have to exist passively anyway, but the way that we cope with them and the way that we are psychologically kind of have evolved, to experience loss and darkness is that it really empowers us to, you know, like, I'm glad it exists because if it didn't, I don't think we would really truly appreciate what we have.
Yeah.
And you have to have those borderlines in order, you know, sort of our parameters of normalcy or of what's kind of the default state are really set by these extreme ends. And if you don't have these extreme ends, where you hang out in what's normal can be kind of really skewed. And that's sort of what's happening in the country right now, right? I think like rationality is skewing to one side, which is really dangerous because the extreme ends have moved so far to one side.
Well, I agree. There needs to be an ebb and flow and a balance. And, you know, you need things that to jockey your perspective. I totally agree. But I do not agree with like just this biological happenstance that took place. Like, you know, we only get to live maybe if we're lucky. Maybe we get 80 years. You know, a lot of people don't get 80 years.
Yeah.
And like, that's nothing. It's like, I've been saying this to a lot of my friends. I'm just getting my shit together right now. I'm 49 years old. I'm just figuring out my life. I'm like, I got things are starting to really happen that are good, and I'm really getting it together. And I'm like, I don't have that much time left.
Can you imagine living back in an era when, like, you would be elderly?
Yeah.
Isn't that insane? Yeah, or you'd be dead.
It wasn't that. Yeah.
You'd be like the wise elder of the community.
But I wish that I could, you know, like Steve said, I want to go back. I want to be 20 with what I've accomplished today.
Yeah.
I would love to have another 50 healthy years ahead of me where I don't have to worry about death. And, you know, I want to see my kids, you know, get through large portions of their lives and everything. And that's just not the reality we live in.
Yeah.
I heard a story from a listener today that blew my mind. A guy lost his family.
Oh, gosh.
And I cried after I talked to him. God,
it's tough to hear.
Yeah.
My kids are so important to me. I can't imagine. Yeah. Why does life have to be so up that kids can die? You know, like, why does it have to be that way?
It'd be interesting to see if there really is kind of a bimodal distribution of belief, where you've got the people who have led the most charmed lives and who kind of have the luxury of belief because things are going well. Because, you know, a lot of times when people talk about, like, horrible experiences and far off places, famines and floods. And then people are like, how could God allow that? I was, oh yeah, but they don't think about that every day. So you got those people, but then you have like the massive have nots, the people who are so desperate that they kind of need the faith to keep them going. It seems like there is this special place in the middle, you know, where you're content and you are dialed in and you try to understand what's happening in the world around you and you exercise empathy as often as possible. And you have experienced loss, but maybe not on such a grand scale, where maybe we actually have the luxury of disbelief.
Sure. You know what I mean? I agree too. Yeah. I totally, you're right. We are in a pocket.
Yeah.
You know, I don't go hungry. I was pissed off today. I didn't have enough calories and it was like 5:30. And I'm like,
really,
I got a headache and I got hangry, like big time hangry today. I started like
hangry. I learned that word today.
I love that word.
Hangry is such a good word.
It hits the nail on the head.
Jake sends a text. I'm hangry.
Yeah. Like,
typo? What's this? And then, okay. Hungry, angry.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I'm so privileged. I'm so freaking lucky just to have the life I've already had. And yet again, I want, you know, I'd like another 1,000 years.
But of course, wouldn't we all? Yeah. I mean, so long as I'm like young. Yeah. I don't want to be old forever. Be younger forever. It'd be cool. So.
Yep.
I think because I'm probably like chronologically the newest skeptic. You know, a lot of people find skepticism first and then maybe atheism or maybe science is out. Like I found atheism and then science and then skepticism. So I was always sort of practicing, but I never knew what it was called and I never had really defined it and I definitely didn't know there was a movement. And so I don't know if I have holdovers as much as like I'm a product of my environment and I'm an Angeleno. I live in Los Angeles and it is like I do regular yoga practice. I try to do yoga every day and I have a wonderful studio that I go to. It's not goat yoga.
You guys know what goat yoga is? You must assume.
There is
in my have goats stand on them while they're doing
in my app. In my app, there is a puppy yoga exercise.
Oh,
like hold your dog. But no, in class, you know, sometimes they start talking about your chakras. And I'm like, why don't they offer secular yoga? Like, this would be great.
Secular yoga.
So it's that I actually do engage, or I get Chinese foot massages a lot. They feel amazing. I need them for my feet. But then when they start talking about your liver while they're poking, I'm like, shut up, you're ruining it.
Yeah.
And so that's the thing. I do engage in sometimes things that have a woo component, and I feel guilty about, like, feeding the cause, but at the same time, I get what I need to get out of it, and
it's fine. It's helpful. I mean, you're living in such a dense environment of that stuff. Like, what are you going to do? I mean, whatever.
Yeah. If I feel like if I voted with my dollar on every decision I made, I would actually be denying myself. Yeah. Some of the things about life that help me get a better work-life balance and help me with self-care.
Just sad. That gets back to my answer, how frustrating it is that there is so much nonsense infused in everyday life. It just drives me crazy.
Yeah, it's tough.
All right, Bob, what's your question?
Yes, I think it's time for a fun question.
Ooh.
All right, imagine science fiction. Everything that's been written, everything that's any science fiction movie, TV show, audio, anything.
Yeah.
Pick one science fiction technology or discrete technological object that exists in science fiction. Which one? You could have one. Any one. Which one would you have? Anything in science. We'll start with Evan and go down.
Oh, what was it? It was Peabody and the time machine, of course. Of course. You have to be able to go back and forth through time. I think to me, that one just isn't a no-brainer for me. Because the possibilities are endless, and just think of the knowledge you can accumulate
through such a device.
Okay.
It just, it seems endless, boundless to me, the possibilities.
Yeah. So time travel, the classic choice of time travel.
Yes.
But what's the method though? What does Peabody use? I forget what that cartoon, what did he use?
Right. With the Wayback Machine, right. It was an actual machine.
It's usually like a closet with a dial on
it. Yeah, a booth of some sort. I think Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, you know, they've ripped it off.
Think about, if you could do that, Evan, there would be no need for forensic science.
Yeah.
Like, isn't that insane? Like, that whole field would be obsolete because you could just go.
Yeah, but he'd have to go investigate everything. That would get really tiring.
We shouldn't time travel to save the...
But the TARDIS is the best time travel machine.
Okay. All right. I'll give you the TARDIS. Sure.
If you're going for time travel, TARDIS.
But also, if you remember, and this is actually kind of interesting with happening with Doctor Who, did anybody see that Louis C.K. sketch where he's talking about time travel and how it's like fundamentally a white man's privilege? They're like, a white man can go back to the year one, and they're like, welcome, table for you. But he's like, black people can't time travel. They can't go past 1980. Yeah, like, there's just like, and like, women don't want to go, I don't want to go back in time. Like, that doesn't sound like fun to me. This is like fundamentally a white man's privilege. Time
I want to go back in time and look at, and see when the moon was 15 times closer to the
Earth. That would be really cool.
And see that big thing.
I'll just go back with you, but I'll dress like a man.
Just don't go to the shore though, because, I mean,
the tidal forces will wash me over.
The tides were as big as a mountain and would go hundreds of miles inland. Ooh, and scour the...
Gosh.
I mean, tides were not fun back then. Don't go too close to the shore.
Yeah.
All right, Steve.
I mean, the thing is, the time machine, like a TARDIS, could be the answer to... Then you might grant you access to every other technological device you ever would want, because then you just go into the future.
That's true, yeah.
And get it. But it depends on what you think we're going to be able to develop in the future, right? So... I would say the TARDIS if I had the faith that 1,000 years from now we're going to have all the cool shit that I would otherwise want, right? But is there a technological device in science fiction that I think we'll never have, and I would rather have that?
Yeah.
And if that's the case, I would get the regeneration machine from Elysium.
Yeah.
The movie Elysium, where you basically 100% regeneration.
Yeah.
That's a good choice.
Oh, yeah, then
perfect
you don't have
health
to die.
Forever. Yeah, that's kind of hard to beat that.
Yeah, but
get into the future the slow way.
But you consider that to be a possible technology that might not exist in the future?
You didn't say possible. You didn't say possible. You just
But you consider the Elysium healing device to be one of those things that
may
not exist?
Well, it's possible we will never invent something that powerful displayed in that movie.
Yeah.
You're taking a chance. If this is your choice, and you chose the TARDIS, and 100 years from now we blow ourselves up, oops.
Yeah.
Right.
Maybe.
But then
just go backwards.
Right. Just go back and stop from happening.
Right.
Yeah. That device. No, that medical device.
I probably would go for the TARDIS. But since everyone picked the time machine, that would be my second choice. Would be something like the regeneration machine, because then basically, you know, there's no disease, there's no illness, there's no frailty, there's no old age.
Is that what the doctor in Prometheus had, or the wealthy guy? Did he have something similar to that? He had
nothing like
it. Wasn't like that.
That was like a remote surgery machine.
Yeah, yeah. No, in Elysium, basically, like, it rebuilds your body from a set of cellular level. I mean, it was unlimited regeneration. Yeah.
That was an amazing... I've thought of that device many times since
I saw
that movie.
That's on the short list.
No, that was pretty cool.
That was an amazing device. Jay, what do you got?
All right, so, I mean, isn't it obvious? What's my answer, Bob?
A lightsaber?
I mean, yeah, that would be...
Lots of things.
Han Solo's blaster.
I don't even have to dip into science fiction, even though people have written about it as science. Nanotechnology will give you... Super advanced nanotechnology will solve the engineering problem of health. It'll let you manufacture anything that's pretty much in the realm of physics to manufacture, which is that's literally you're hitting the edge of what we can achieve.
But you have to go through all these steps to do it. Like, a lot of these sci-fi things are just like a room you go in and then everything's fixed. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, is there anything, like, this is bottom-up technology. Is there any, like, quick fix from science fiction?
All right, so I mean, you want me? Is it more of the fantasy? You're saying like fantasy?
I have no idea.
Like, what's the cool thing?
It has to be a specific item from some fiction.
Yeah, well, nanotech. I mean, I've read plenty of fiction books about
mature
nanotechnology.
That's an awesome choice.
Think about it. I mean, what better? I mean, because time travel to me is it's dangerous. And I respect reality temporally, and I would not want to mess with that in any way.
Yeah.
And I also think
it's a little scary. For sure.
I have a little bit of a you know, like the 5% thing I told you, a 0.5%. I'm like hoping that there's a multiverse. I just think a multiverse is such a cool idea. So if I had nanotechnology, I'm gonna like basically trick myself out in the realm of physics. I'm going to be it when you have fully fledged nanotechnology. So then you know, then I'm net, my life's goal then will be to find another universe to live, a younger universe to live in. And just keep going, man.
No, that's a good choice. Yeah. I mean, I might chose femto technology, but that's, you know, that's just same idea, though. Same idea, smaller scale, though. But yeah, that's great, Jay. Nanotech. But what would you choose, Kara, from science fiction?
It's a hard, because I'm working through it in my head right now, and I'm thinking, I don't want to fuck with time travel at all. But, like, I don't know if, like, a hyperdrive or, like, a wormhole situation, like, or, like, a transporter kind of a situation to
No.
That's not good.
No, transporters. You die when you go to a transporter.
Oh, I don't want that.
No.
Is there something else where you can just go to a different place really fast?
Yeah, you want to make a wormhole.
Yeah, like, but that's not a technology. That's just utilized.
Yeah, there's,
okay.
But there's, yeah, of course.
So I think about that, and then I'm like, okay, that's cool. But then it also
sort of is
lonely to me. Like, you were talking about going to another place and, like, starting your own civilization. I don't really want to do that. Like, for me, a lot of, when I think about sci-fi and the things that are really beautiful to me, it's about culture and it's about interacting with individuals. And so, like, I'm thinking back maybe to Contact and to Arrival. And I think one of the differences, I mean, there are a lot of differences, but is that in Contact, she was able to communicate, like, the aliens, like, changed their form so they could communicate with her. But in Arrival, she basically just had the educational prowess to learn their speech. And so if there were some sort of technology where I could be empowered to read the communication of other species, of maybe even alien species, but definitely other species on the planet. To
a,
like,
babelfish.
Yeah, to,
yeah, that
the thing.
Would be cool.
Okay, what is that?
The babelfish.
The babelfish.
I'm so bad at
this game. Anytime that they start, I always, anytime
it's
they're like,
a lot of catch up. It's okay.
Anytime they're like, what is the technology? I'm like, I've seen like 5 sci-fi movies. Like, why are you doing this? It's like very limited here, but at least this was sci-fi. Not
that's Douglas Adams.
This I know. 42. Guide. I know that. Yep.
and that's all you need.
But he can read. So what does it allow you to do? To just read minds?
No, to understand any other language.
Yeah. See, because that seems to me, reading minds gets a little on the crazy side. Although, you know, a lot of people say, like, what's the superpower you'd want? That's usually the one I come up with. But you would also have to have, like, a kill switch.
Oh, you have to turn
you
it off.
You have to have something where you can turn it
right.
off. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
But yeah, okay. Being able to communicate with anything, any other being in existence in the multiverse.
Yeah, that would be cool.
That would be cool.
That'd be cool.
Yeah.
So when I've thought about this a lot, I wrote a blog post actually on this. I picked the top 10 things in science fiction that I would love to have. So a few of the ones that I think are great ideas. One is a starship, is it, right?
Yeah.
A starship with a warp drive. So I picked the Enterprise NCC-1701J. Now that's in science fiction. It's been covered on one of the Enterprise episodes. This is the Enterprise from the 26th century. So this thing is
tricked out.
It totally tricked out. It's miles long. It's got some new advanced, like some weird transwarp, so we can go to other galaxies. It's just like the ultimate version of the Enterprise that's actually in the literature. It's in the sci-fi universe somewhere. So the cool thing about it, having a ship, is that if you have the ship, you also have lots of technologies that are part of the ship. So it's not like, oh, I want a transporter. If you pick a ship, you've got the transporter, you've got the holodeck, you've got the medical technology, you've got everything that's a part of the ship.
I thought you didn't want a transporter because you'll die. I'm so confused.
Well, I mean,
full anti-transporter.
This is why I never can keep up. It's like I'm always getting different
information. That's a legit concern.
Okay.
And I would actually think.
We'll talk about this later.
I might not avail myself of a transporter because you're basically killing yourself to transport yourself. So you can look at it that way, the whole continuity problem. But that's beside the point.
Okay.
A ship like that would be an amazing thing to have. It's in science fiction, so that would be wonderful. So that's one thing that I would pick. Another one that I picked was, if anyone has seen Forbidden Planet, there was this Krell technology that essentially was the pinnacle of technology in that it could read your mind, and whatever you were thinking, it would then manufacture for you and transport that anywhere on the planet. So that was,
it is dangerous.
I mean, the moral of the story.
I would modify the technology so that you wouldn't it wouldn't be anything that you were thinking. It would be something that you actually had to input some other way.
What if you switch that thing to evil?
but that's an amazingly powerful piece of science.
Yes, I really want you to do that.
Yes, an amazing piece of science.
fiction.
What
technology.
About the thing in it's in Guardians of the Galaxy, right? Where like the little raccoon guy is like when the ship's all damaged, he's just like beep.
He's just spraying
it. Yeah, he just spraying it and just like, fixes everything.
But you're thinking too small. You're thinking
really?
Too small. Yeah, way
to be
too
able to
small.
Fix anything that's ever broken without
we don't
doing
know.
Anything?
We don't know the limits of that technology, but my choice is
I feel like that sounds like a pretty cool thing to me.
That's good. That's a top 15.
Okay. All right.
Choice,
not quite top
15. But it's not a top 5. It's not a top 5. I'll tell you what my top 1 choice was.
Please.
This was something now I don't know this is obscure, but it's out there. Orion's Arm is this website that covers, it's just this huge kind of universe of like, of documentation and literature that people have come up with and images about various advanced technologies throughout the universe. And when they cover nanotechnology, they cover femtotechnology, they cover faster than light travel. But there was this one article that somebody wrote that I never forgot, and it dealt with upgrading a human. It's essentially an upgrade device to a human. When you upgrade, when you connect this thing to yourself, I think it was a pill that you swallowed or it was something that you attached to yourself. And there was this artificial intelligence within it that would then go through your body and upgrade your body. The first thing it would do, it would upgrade your body in a way that made it would just make it stronger. It would kind of put like, your nerves are very slow and they're very fragile. It would upgrade the nerves because if you're souping up your brain, you need your body to be able to do what your brain wants it to do. So it basically would beef up your body in that way. And then it would upgrade your mind, basically turning it into computronium. You may have heard of computronium. That's this idealized substrate where it's a computer technology that's as dense as the laws of physics allow. So basically, if you had a chunk as big as a cell, it would be the equivalent of the human brain in terms of what it could do. So it basically converts your brain into this computronium, basically turning your mind into a super hyper, the fastest computer you can ever imagine. So it upgrades your mind and makes you, and then it says to you, okay, I have upgraded your body. You are now about 10 times smarter than you were. Where do you want to go next? Do you want to make yourself 100 times smarter? Do you want to make yourself 1,000,000 times smarter? Where do you want to end this process? And then you would say, all right, I only want to do this for now. And I think it makes sense. If you were going to upgrade your mind, I would love to know what it was like to be 1,000 times or 1,000,000 times smarter.
Haven't you read Flowers for Algernon?
Let me finish.
Morals of the story.
The point is that I would not want to make myself 1,000 times smarter because then people would be like dealing with like cats or bacteria. I wouldn't want to.
But
I wouldn't,
everybody else would have this technology too, right?
No, not necessarily.
That's where this is where the, like when I was
talking
to Jay.
The premise is that you are getting a technology that only you have. This is what I would do.
Gotcha.
I might share it. I might share it if I wanted to. But this is something that I think would be fascinating to be able to turn myself into somebody. That, imagine what you could do if you were 1,000 times smarter. You could create a lot
lonely.
Of these other.
This is so what happened to Barclay. That Next Generation
my
episode.
Favorite became, Star Trek episode. Yeah. Because of that, I love the idea of what it would be like to upgrade yourself. He saved the Enterprise multiple times. He did a lot of amazing things, but eventually he got so smart he integrated his mind into the computer system of the Enterprise
and changed the ship so that it was capable of going to a place where it couldn't go before in order to meet a new species.
That had a positive outcome.
But that I think yes. I know where Kara was going with this. I mean, to me, like this human interaction thing in life, I don't want to belittle it in any way, it is magical. I mean, we're so hardwired to interact.
Right.
If you did that, not to put it down, it's a cool idea, of course. I think it's great. But if I was 1,000 times smarter than every human on the planet,
you'd
have no one to talk to.
You'd be so
exactly,
sad.
Exactly, Jay. That's exactly my point. I would not want to be so many times smarter that I couldn't deal with people. I would like to do this. Like, all right, I want to research a cure to cancer. So for the next hour, I'm going to just
dial
turn this
up.
Dial, and yeah. I'll be 1,000,000 times smarter for an hour, and then it'll go down by itself because I don't want to. You know, cause you could easily think
you'll never
want to come back.
Yeah.
So it'd have to be like on auto stupid. It's like, bring me down to baseline human
but
after
then,
an hour.
How
but then,
depressed would you be once you were stupid again? I don't know.
I don't know.
Like, it's so tough.
I'm willing to
I would bet
that
the dumber you are, the happier you are, right?
Maybe. But imagine, so I like when you're wishing for something or wishing for a superpower, I like the idea of having a superpower that could eventually give you all the other superpowers. So you don't, in a sense, you're like wishing for more wishes.
Yeah.
So this is what that bit of science fiction technology would do. You would be able to create all these other, you would create warp drive, nanotech, and anything everybody else decided with this.
It's not a fun answer to have it be every answer. That's the thing. Like,
hey, but the premise of my question was something in science fiction that you would pick, and that's what I would
pick. And what's it called again, this thing?
This was a document on the Orion's Arm website that has a host of science fiction technologies.
And this specific technology was called, remember?
It had some technical name.
But it was something, it was like something you swallowed or injected.
Yeah, it's a human
upgrade.
Yeah.
All right, it's nanotechnology.
All right, we need to move on. So let me do my question, then we do science fiction. Okay.
Right. Oh, we have a science
here fiction. Here it is. Cirrus Nano Cyborg Ascension Regimen.
That's what it is.
Of course. Say it.
So I'm never that upset when I lose a couple nerd points. Like, it's not.
Right. No, you lost no points.
Like I said, that's obscure as hell.
Okay.
Fascinating.
So this is my question. So let's say that skeptical activism is a video game, right? Mm-hmm. And you guys have just leveled up.
Mm-hmm.
So now you can use your experience to purchase a new skill set or perk or feat or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. So you can add something to your skin. This is a fun way of just saying, what skill set or knowledge base or whatever would you like to add to what you already have? And again, let's say you could hit the button and say, all right, I would like to be able to do X. And, you know, it's not the kind of thing like where you just read an article and you have it. Like a serious set of skills that you don't have.
Okay.
So we'll start at this end now.
All right.
What would you want to add to your skill set?
So we all know that we struggle with like cognitive biases, right? Like confirmation bias and all these like errors in thinking. And we know how to read about them. And we know that we're every day trying to recognize them in ourselves. And sometimes we don't notice until after the fact. And I just want like a hyper acuity for when I am committing an error of thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, I just want to instantly know it so I can correct it in real time.
That's a cool idea.
That would be amazing. Because then I'd just be like an amazing skeptic all the time.
Just you want to be more rational.
Just, yeah. Like, but I want to like all of the things where we have evolved these special skills, these shortcuts that sometimes screw us, I want to be aware of them right away.
You don't think you're aware enough now?
No, I think we often find ourselves kind of either after the fact or a little too late. It's kind of like when we play name that logical fallacy. Like I have to think about it, to go through and diagram. Mm. I want to just see it. Yeah, I just want to feel it immediately. Right, yeah, like that would be really cool.
Yeah. It is really cool.
Yeah, that's cool. I would pick like that. You know, I'm visualizing the video game. It's like I'm picking the new header branch into a whole new category. I think there are way too few truly inspiring science communicators out there that really, the way that Carl Sagan did it for us, sucked you in. It was a romance.
Like speaking skill then.
Yeah, like a real ability to get people, like I've had the pleasure in our career on this podcast listening to a lot of amazing speakers. And there's like that charisma that goes with it. And it's like you come to, you know, they're welcoming you into the love and mystery. Like Bill Nye's got it. Neil deGrasse Tyson's got it. Carl Sagan's got it. I've heard a lot of other people that have that. There's not enough of those people out there.
Yeah.
So I would love, you know, unfortunately it's never going to happen, but that would be a skill set that I would love to share with the world. Like just inspire people to, you know, I'm going to go home after hearing this person talk and like change my life because
the motivational speaking.
Yeah, something really powerful. Yeah.
Okay, Bob.
But I've often thought that I would, as Steve is like the expert doctor, right? You're a doctor, right?
Yeah, I am a
doctor. He's a doctor. he's a doctor on the show, medicine. I would have loved to have been the physics counterpart to Steve.
Yeah.
A mirror image of Steve in a lot
That's
of
funny.
Ways.
You want a PhD
with,
in physics.
With yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Now, I mean, I love physics. I know a lot of physics. I got a layman's understanding of physics, but I don't have a deep, deep, like mathematical understanding of physics. Yeah. I would love to have that kind of expertise.
Do you think that would make you a better skeptic though? Because there are physicists at that level who are like believe in God.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
He's already a skeptic.
Yeah,
he just wants
true.
To add this specific
so
expertise.
Would, yeah.
So which is fine. That's a
Yeah, like a Sean Carroll level of like
exactly.
Yeah,
I would suck his mind into mine so easily. I'd love it.
I'd love it. Until he fell over like an empty husk. Yeah.
So suck his mind with a fine Chianti.
Here's a skill I like. I'm not a prolific writer. You're a prolific writer. I am not.
So writing skills.
I will boost my writing skills.
Yeah, that's a good
one. My output, definitely.
Oh, if I could read faster. Way, oh my god.
Or bow hunting skills.
Bow hunting. How about nunchuck skills? Yeah. All right. Bob, science or fiction?
Oh yeah.
It's time for science or fiction.
This is not science or fiction. This is Dragon Con or fiction.
Okay.
All right.
All right. It's got a theme. Ha. Huh? And it's got four. It's got four pieces to it. So.
Why are you looking at me?
Because you always do that to us. Okay.
Because you're basically the science or fiction asshole. That's
So here are four facts about Dragon Con, primarily the history of Dragon Con. Three of them are true. One of them is totally wrong.
Awesome.
Okay.
Dragon Con. All right. So let's go. All right. DragonCon was launched in 1987 as an outgrowth evolution of a local science fiction and gaming group, the Dragon Alliance of Gamers and Role Players. Okay, number two. In 2002, DragonCon began hosting its famous parade through downtown Atlanta. Number three, the 1987 inaugural DragonCon took place at the Piedmont Plaza Hotel and drew 140 fans. And number four, in 2015, DragonCon attracted some 70,000 attendees and had direct economic impact of $65 million. So, all right, we'll start over here.
All right.
Read it again, if you don't mind, Ev.
DragonCon was launched in 1987 as an outgrowth evolution of a local science fiction and gaming group, the Dragon Alliance of Gamers and Role Players, also known as DAGR. All right, well, definitely is 30 years, so I don't think it's a problem with that. And the gaming group and science fiction, yeah, I think that one is going to be correct. The second one. In 2002, DragonCon began hosting its famous parade through downtown Atlanta. Well, I don't know when the parade started. Started in 2002. That could be the case. It very much could not be the case. So that just comes down to the year. The third one, the 1987 inaugural DragonCon took place at the Piedmont Plaza Hotel and drew 140 fans. Again, the Piedmont Plaza Hotel, does that even still exist? 140 fans. That could be the starting number for a convention. I think Randy's TAM convention drew, I think, about 150 people, something in that neighborhood. Not that that's really scaled up to that point now, but yeah, sounds about right. In 2015, DragonCon attracted some 70,000 attendees and had a direct economic impact of $65 million. The only thing I would say about that one is I thought the number would be higher, but I could be off on that. I thought it was more like 80,000, 90 maybe. I'm going to say that the parade won, 2002. It started at some other year.
Steve?
Yeah.
Is that font too small for you?
No. I'll cut to the chase. I'll say the 140 people is a fiction. I think the first one was bigger.
Jay.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with Steve and say that DragonCon, I'm sorry. The one I wanted to say was it didn't start at the Piedmont Hotel. I think that one's the fake.
But that's the same one.
It's the same one. Gotcha. Okay. Just different reason.
I was thinking of the same one, but I thought maybe there were less than 140 fans at the first meeting. So I'm going to go with also number three, which is 1987, Piedmont Plaza Hotel, 140 fans, for a slightly different reason.
Bob, you want to poll the audience before we move on?
Yeah. Guys, give a clap when if you agree with these options as I read them. So DragonCon was launched in 87 as an outgrowth evolution of local science fiction and gaming group.
If you think it's the fiction, clap.
Okay.
It's about five people.
Two. Okay. A little weak.
In 2002, DragonCon began hosting its famous parade through downtown Atlanta.
Okay.
Ooh, six,
1987's 11. Inaugural DragonCon took place at the Piedmont Plaza Hotel and drew 140 fans.
Lemmings, they are.
Six, yeah. Seven.
In 2015, DragonCon attracted some 70,000 plus attendees and had a direct economic impact of $65 million.
That could
be the
stealth
fiction.
You know,
he's going to be the big winner.
That could be the stealth fiction.
So it looks like they agree with us.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, there's not much to say about the ones that are correct, right? I mean, it's not like
well,
it's not like a news item.
Just say yes.
So I'll say the fiction
I'll say that you guys are correct. You guys,
yes. But for what reason?
I'm really pissed at you all. Because DragonCon's first conference had 1,400 fans. I lowered it by an order of magnitude.
And what hotel?
That is huge for the very first year. That is immense. That's really big.
So, but didn't you say it grew out of something else?
The
other one?
Everything else is correct.
But can you reread the first one that was correct?
Sure. DragonCon was launched in 87 as an outgrowth or evolution of a local science fiction and gaming group. And the Dragon Alliance of Gamers and Role Players. So that's really what it came from.
Yeah, so that could have easily been 140 people, but it was 1,400 that all
It was 1,400. Yeah, 140 does sound reasonable for the very first. And I thought that was the only one that really I felt I could change and bring it down.
That's good.
I was thinking of the $65 million. When changing these, I couldn't make it from 65 to like 80 million because that's too little. You need a big change.
That's a jerk move.
That'd be a total.
I think we all agree that order of magnitude changes are appropriate.
Right. So I was thinking $650 million, $500 million. No, that's not going to happen. How about $6.5 million? That's not enough.
Yeah. I would have believed the $650 million after what I spent yesterday.
Point taken, Jay. I agree. So that to me, that was the only one that I really felt like a change. But you guys still saw it through it.
All right. So was it the Piedmont Hotel though? Is that a fact?
The only thing I changed out of all of this was to change 1,400 from 140.
That's okay. That was good.
It's a good change.
All right,
that was
good. All right. All right.
Still didn't work. At least I got this guy.
You guys,
I rolled a four-sided die and got it wrong. You know what are you gonna do?
Yeah, guys, if you guys want to stay a few minutes, we'll take any of your questions.
Before
we do the quote to close this out. Does anybody have any questions?
So the question, because obviously that wasn't recorded, was we talked about this news story that's trending, right, about a guy who was running a fake forensics mill. Yeah. And yeah, like it's ruining kind of
forensics.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know,
junk science in our courts.
I've definitely been following a lot of, and I didn't see that study yet, so I need to read up on that. I think I've been DragonCon distracted, but I definitely have been following a lot of ProPublica does a lot of really good investigative work with like talk about basically pseudoscience and forensics. How even beyond, you know, actual outright fraud, fingerprint science is incredibly unreliable.
Yeah.
It's nothing like we try to think it is. And there's a lot of aspects of forensic science that, because so much of it is just about convincing juries.
Yeah.
It's really a lot less about being true to the evidence. And so, I do think that's an interesting topic. Maybe I'll start, I'll add it to my feed reader. I keep a feed reader to look up stories.
We've
so maybe I'll do
before,
some forensics.
But not as much as
necessary. Yeah,
that's interesting. It really is. It's a huge scandal.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of pseudoscience and forensic science that's getting into the courtroom.
And it's a bummer because there's so much good science.
It needs a revolution.
Yeah.
We used to we had the Flexner Report in 1910 for medical schools that half of them closed and they had established one solid standard. We need a similar thing, like a Flexner Report for forensic science where we really clean it up a lot.
And
it
sounds
like a charismatic person can walk into a courtroom with some pie charts and sway the jury and that's
In
reality, it goes out the window.
Plenty of examples of that. If you want to learn kind of about the beginnings of forensic science, it was actually a chemist who sort of revolutionized and started putting real data, like evidentiary data, in the court system. There's a really great book by Deborah Blum called The Poisoner's Handbook. Mm. And they did a PBS, I think it was an American Experience episode based on, it's a multi-part, really beautiful documentary. And they talk all about this chemist who first figured out how to find a certain chemical in stomach contents and purify it and then present
cool.
To say this person definitely didn't poison so-and-so. This was just a remnant of another thing that they ate. And it's really interesting to see the beginnings of that.
All right, Evan, bring us home with a quote.
Beauty is truth, truth beauty. That is all ye know on earth and all ye need to know. John Keats from his poem Ode on a Grecian Urn.
Aww.
And you may recognize that spoken in the movie Quiz Show for any of those who are Quiz Show fans.
Yeah.
And I know Perry was a huge fan of that movie as I was as well. And it speaks obviously to the truth, which is what that entire movie was about. It was uncovering the fraud that was going on with the quiz shows, specifically 21 at the time. So
more respect for truth would be a good thing.
More respect for truth, definitely.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you all for joining me on the show.
Sure, Steve. Yeah,
Steve. Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you all for joining me in the audience. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Thank you, guys. That was awesome.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.